This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Monty Wente-Reme. I played Icheb on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Metatrex on Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 60 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frueling. Today, we're going to be joined by a special guest to discuss essential Trek philosophy from Season 6 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Zachary, how are you today?
I'm doing great today. I'm always looking forward to talking about Deep Space Nine, and Season 6 is one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek in general, and I couldn't be more excited to have Duncan join us again. It's been a few episodes since we had him on Metatrex, and always great to hear Duncan's perspective on things.
Yes, as our listeners are well aware, Duncan Barrett is the London-based author and editor, author of such works as Men of Letters, The Girls Who Went to War, and of course, Star Trek The Human Frontier. Very familiar name around the Babel Conference. So Zachary, we should say to our listeners that we are anticipating a two-part conversation because Deep Space Nine Season 6 is such a great season. We don't want to rush the conversation, and Duncan brings so much to the table in terms of his insight into history, and we just want to give an opportunity for this to be a good deep dive into not only Season 6 of Deep Space Nine, but also kind of collecting his insights and his thoughts on the parallels to the Second World War and some of his own research. So this is the first part of a two-part conversation. And I just got a hail from the USS Britain. He is ready to beam aboard. So, Transporter Chief, energize. Duncan, welcome back to the Starship of Theseus. How are you, sir?
Hi, good to see you both again. I'm well. How are you?
Doing well. This is your second time aboard, so we're glad to bring you in. We're going to be talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Season 6, choosing some essential philosophy. Do you have any thoughts on the process you used to come up with your list?
Well, I hope you. I have to say, my list is we were talking about a bit in the turbo lift. Probably less metaphysical than maybe some of your essential philosophy. I was kind of more maybe looking for the kind of ethics issues, which I guess suits this season. But my approach as well is that one of the reasons that I was quite keen to come and talk to you about DS9 Season 6 is that. As you mentioned, a lot of the books that I write, ordinarily, they're not about science fiction. They're about usually the Second World War. That's kind of my patch. So I was partly looking at this season through the lens of kind of Second World War history and the way that that ties into the writing and the way that some of these episodes illuminate some of the kind of ethical issues around that war and war in general. Because I guess this is kind of really where we get into, in a sort of meaty way, the kind of DS9 war arc and the kind of... you know, what kind of issues that raises, what kind of questions that raises. And I think with this season, it's probably my favourite season of DS9, one of the best seasons of Star Trek, I think. And I think they really mined that a lot to try and find a lot of different aspects of that to kind of bring to the table.
So we're going to get down into the nitty gritty here in just a few minutes. But a few weeks ago, you reached out to us and you knew that we were going to get up to Season 6 of Deep Space Nine here for Essential Trek Philosophy in a few weeks. And you wrote to us and you said, I want to join you guys for Deep Space Nine Season 6. So even though we're going to get down in the weeds here in a minute, what is it about Season 6 of Deep Space Nine that is such a strong connection to your interest in World War II?
Well, this is going to probably give away where some of my choices are going to be coming from. But yeah, basically at the moment, the book I'm writing writing at the moment is about an occupation, and it's the reason I was interested. It's about the occupation of the Channel Islands, which I don't know how much you or listeners know about this. I don't think it's a story that's all that widely known, but obviously in the Second World War, we know the Germans occupied France, they occupied the other countries in continental Europe, and we know a bit about the kind of brutality there was in those regimes. The occupation of the Channel Islands. The Channel Islands are part of the British Isles. They're quite small islands. They're British territory, but they are geographically closer to the coast of France. So it was quite easy for the Germans to basically walk in and take them. And in fact, slightly controversially, the British didn't fight for them. They decided to demilitarise them voluntarily. Essentially what we see at the end of season 5 of DS9, they basically walked away and said, we can't win this fight, so we're going to have to give them up. And partly because of that, partly because of a desire that the Germans had that they wanted to, you know, their next, that basically this was a stepping stone to invading Britain and occupying Britain. And they, for various reasons, they wanted to prove that they could run an occupation that was not brutal. There was also a kind of racist element that they felt that the British were sort of kindred spirits somehow. They felt they had this history with them. So because they saw these people as essentially British subjects, they treated them better. So one of the things that fascinates me about this topic, and one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, is sort of what are the tensions in that kind of occupation? In a way, if something's really brutal, it's obvious, it's easy, you have to fight to know what to do. And in some ways, what I think was so brilliant about the Deep Space Nine writers at the start of season 6 is that, you know, having had this series, which has all along been so heavily influenced by this Bajoran occupation, this is like the key event in the past, this traumatic event, that they find a way to kind of reenact that event, but yet in some ways they push it further because they do it in shades of grey. Everything we know about the Bajoran occupation, the first Bajoran occupation, yeah, there are shades of grey. You know, we find there are good Cardassians, there are bad Bajorans and so on, but it's a very brutal, very harsh regime. Here they recreate something which is kind of structurally similar, and yet there's a lot more ambiguity. And even in the first episode of the season, you have Quark saying, you know, this isn't so bad, actually. This is kind of not what we were expecting. So that was really what really drew me to this season and why I thought it would be good to come and talk to you a bit about, for me, some of the kind of historical parallels and some of the sort of ethical questions that go along with those.
Well, I'll just say that for me, it's just the sheer volume of just outstanding episodes in season 6. And this is really Star Trek. I mean, when you think about the different iterations of Star Trek, we do this in Voyager. Zachary, you and I just covered 4 episodes, the 6th season of Star Trek Voyager. And there was so much in there to choose from. You know, the writing was spot on. And there's a lot of there's a lot of historical context in there, a lot of historical parallels, a lot of references to the importance of history. And we kind of get that here in season 6 of Deep Space Nine as well. There are a lot of episodes, as Duncan mentioned, that seem to draw parallel to the events of World War II. And I find that really fascinating. As Duncan mentioned, there's not a lot of metaphysical philosophy going on in these episodes, but there's a lot of really interesting ethical dilemmas that take place in this season. And really, some of the strongest episodes of Deep Space Nine are right here in season 6. We get the same thing, you know, by and large for Star Trek: The Next Generation. Season 6 is such a strong. It just seems like Star Trek catches its stride, you know, right there about midway through season 5, and it just goes right through season 6 through about halfway through season 7, and then they start trying to wrap up, you know, the plots, and you know, in my opinion, the writing starts to kind of, you know, go south. And so for me, it was really difficult to kind of narrow down, or as Zachary often refers to, whittling down, to pare down this list into, you know, 3 picks and 2 honorable mentions. That was really difficult because there are such strong stories in the 6th season of Deep Space Nine.
I actually struggled with this quite a bit, even though because season 6 of Deep Space Nine is one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek, many of my favorite episodes in the season don't have much to do with my interest philosophically. they're fun, interesting episodes, but so I struggled to find enough picks for us to talk about today that are philosophy proper. So I'm anxious to compare our picks because I think our interests are so very different. My interests in philosophy tend to be more about metaphysics and epistemology, and I know less about ethics and less about political philosophy. And I think the difference between your perspective and mine on the connection to World War II is interesting, Duncan, because for us, I think over here in America, we never had to experience occupation in the way that a British territory experiencing occupation during World War II happened. So it's a much closer connection to those events than you. And so it's no accident, I think, that your interests veer towards those events culturally. For us, I think it's just harder to identify with being an occupied territory.
Mm. Well, the weird thing is, though, I mean, one of the reasons that I was interested in my research in writing about the Channel Islands is in Britain, we don't talk about it. It's not covered in school. I mean, when I studied history as a teenager in school, we would study the Second World War, we'd study the rise of fascism, we'd look at what things were going on in Germany, we'd cover a little bit about the occupations in Europe. I don't think anyone mentioned that there was British territory that was under occupation. And partly, I think, that was a legacy of there was a kind of... Partly these kind of grey areas and these kind of ambiguities, there was an element of shame around it. There was a kind of... It was sort of something that, at the end of the war, it had caused a lot of... there were a lot of cracks that were going to be sort of papered over, basically, in order for everyone to go back to their normal lives, and a lot of questions about people's conduct, you know, whether people did the right thing, because there weren't, in a sense, these same narratives of resistance and heroic fighting against the Nazis that there were, you know, if you think about the French resistance or so on. And there were a lot of reasons for that, very good reasons why people didn't and couldn't do the same things that they could on the continent. But I think that was part of the reason that it's almost a kind of... It's a part of history, and all my history books, really, I'm always looking for aspects of history that are maybe not the kind of mainstream story. They're kind of a side story onto it in some ways. So that was kind of what drew me to it. But certainly it's closer in the sense that they, you know, the people in these islands culturally, probably I have more in common with. I can go there and visit there, and it's, you know, it's closer to me in that sense. And geographically, of course, it's closer. And the fact that we were, you know, the other aspect of it that interests me is that Britain was nearly invaded. We were nearly occupied. I mean, I don't think that was ever going to happen necessarily for the United States. So it's kind of, this was almost the history that didn't quite come to pass for us. This was our sort of alternate history, our mirror universe, if you like, you know.
Does it conflict at all with the British narrative of being the British Empire? Does the idea of the fact that a British territory can be occupied, does that just conflict with the overall narrative of being an empire?
I think it conflicts with, possibly. I don't see it so much in terms of the empire, but more it conflicts with this idea of we'll never surrender. It's very sort of anti-Churchillian in a sense, what happened. And Churchill was actually very angry about, he was quite new in the job. All his advisors were telling him, we can't defend these islands. You know, militarily, it's just not feasible to defend them. He said, the word he used was repugnant. That was how he felt, the idea of basically giving up, walking away from a fight. And he said, you know, there are people, we can send people who will be willing to fight for these islands. And actually, in the House of Commons, there was an MP who raised the issue. And he said, you know, why is it that in the First World War, we sent millions of men to die over these tiny, sections of land in France, and yet we won't send anyone to fight for islands that are actually British? So there was a kind of controversy to it. And I think it's the reason that's really the myth that it conflicts with to a certain extent, is this idea of we'll never surrender, we'll never give up, we'll keep on fighting no matter what. And that, I suppose, because in the Second World War, you know, the whole of Europe was overrun by the Germans. This was before Russia and America had entered the war. Britain really was fighting the fight on its own, in a sense. And our narrative of the war is very much that we were the ones, you know, this far, no further. This was the kind of line in the sand, in a sense. And I suppose the fact that that line was actually, you know, just ever so slightly into our territory rather than conveniently the other side of the channel, well, is...
I I definitely understand the emotional sense behind not giving an inch, you know, that, that in a situation like that, you're not going to give up any territory, even if it's a bunch of obscure islands, you know, we're not going to give an inch no matter what to the Germans. I understand that completely, no matter what the cost.
Yeah. But that's not what we did. So, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, shall we go ahead and dive in? Duncan, since you are the guest here on the Starship of Theseus, we'll give you first pick.
Okay, well, my first pick is actually episode 2 of this season, Rocks and Shoals. And one of the things that I found when I was looking for my picks was that the episodes that, that really sort of spoke to me and that drew me in, actually, that there was maybe one key sort of issue, sort of philosophical or ethical issue that I was really interested in. But actually, those were the episodes that they seem to have a lot of things going on. And one of the things that I think is great about this episode is it has a fantastic A story and it has a fantastic B story. Just briefly to talk about the A story, you know, down on the planet, there's this whole issue to do with the Jem'Hadar and the ethics of the kind of command structure there, the fact that the Jem'Hadar have to do what the Vorta says, even if they know he's lying to them, even if they don't respect him. And you sort of see that compared to Sisko and his crew and their command structure there, where they, you know, he sort of has earned their respect as well as being their commanding officer. And there's also this question which sort of informs this many episodes in this season. O'Brien and Garak have this debate. O'Brien says there are rules in a war, you know, there are things that you do and you don't do, even in a dire situation. And Garak says, no, actually humans have rules in a war. These things are sort of contingent. You know, he doesn't recognize those rules and he thinks they're almost in the way. So the stuff on the planet I find interesting from a sort of historical perspective. I can't help thinking of it in terms of the First World War, because you have with the Jem'Hadar and the Vorta, this very strong parallel to my mind anyway. The Vorta are these kind of pasty, pallid sort of intellectual types. They're not very courageous. This is to slightly, because I'm making a connection between the officers and men of the First World War, and that's slightly to slander the officers, who in many cases were very heroic and decent people. But it is that sense that they're from different worlds, they have different expectations. You know, the British Army in the First World War, you'd have the officers often in a very difficult situation. They're commanding men who in some senses often were older than them, more experienced in battle, you know, more kind of intrinsically heroic in some senses. But the order of things, the class system in Britain dictated that the ones who'd been to the, you know, expensive schools got to be in charge of the other men, even if they knew more about it than they did. So I feel like this episode has all this stuff going on in the planet that's fantastic and fascinating. But then it also, the thing that really drew me in, and in some ways, I almost wanted to choose those first 6 episodes as one story, because my interest is in occupation, because I'm so fascinated by this idea of, you know, good occupation versus bad occupation, the ethics of an occupation where it's not so black and white, it's not so brutal and obvious. But of those 6 episodes, I felt this is the one which is kind of the turning point, because this is the one where Kira realizes actually she can't go along with this anymore. You know, we see her at the start of the episode. She's sort of trying to just make the best of it. She's following orders, to be fair. You know, Sisko has told her to keep things, you know, running, to stay there. Bajor is in this difficult situation. She's protecting Bajor. She's very much in the situation of the rulers of the Channel Islands, who were, you know, the islands were demilitarized. The British Army left the islands and they basically said to them, look, you're in charge now. And in a way that they hadn't been before, because previously there'd always been a British representative, a representative of the Crown in the islands, and they withdrew because they, you know, they were giving up the territory. And so those people who were left behind had to kind of reach an accommodation with the Germans and work out, you know, how are we going to do this? And it was a difficult question. So what fascinates me really is, for Kira, what is it that kind of opens her eyes to the fact that she can't go along with this? And it also ties into this idea of what is sort of what is acceptable, what, you know, where is the line that's going to be crossed? And I suppose what the Vedic is saying to her, and also what Jake is prompting, is this idea, this is an occupation, this is wrong, you know, some kind of resistance is necessary. The Vedic says evil must be opposed, whereas Kira is sort of saying, well, you know, it's not that bad. You know, Quark has been saying in the previous episode, it's not that bad. Is it best to kind of go along with it and try and, you know, keep the trains running on time and so on? Or is there a point where you kind of have to do something? So I think the episode asks a lot of these questions. And it also touches on kind of historical aspects with the Vedic committing suicide. Very much reminds me of the Buddhist mm-hmm. monks you saw in the Vietnam War protesting that, you know, taking these really extreme measures to try to demonstrate a kind of gesture of conscience, in a sense. Also interesting that it's Jake who is the thing that tips the balance, because in this, you know, in this whole six episode arc, it's surprising in a way that he should be the one who's prodding initially, and it is kind of touching a raw nerve both for Odo and Kira, which I suppose tells us also something about, you know, the importance of the free press to avoid a kind of totalitarian regime. Very topical as we're recording today. There's been a lot of debate sure. about, you know, people being excluded from the White House. And in some ways, I suppose a lot of the debates that we're having today are, you know, about American politics are kind of, well, OK, it might not be, you know, concentration camps and this sort of thing, but there are these other worrying signs that historically connect to these totalitarian regimes. You know, the situation on Deep Space Nine in this occupation, the crucial nub of the argument between Kira and the Vedic is, well, even if it's not as brutal as before, even if it's not as awful as what we had before, freedoms are being curtailed, our lives are being taken over, we are living under a totalitarian regime, even if it's a mild one. And is that a state that we can continue to accept, basically, and to go along with?
So Rocks and Shoals was my first choice as well, interestingly enough. And I think for the same reason, it speaks to one of the fundamental questions in political philosophy, which is that are ethics and justice concepts that apply only in civilized society, or do they apply in a pre-civilized state of nature or a state of war? And the situation that we see on the planet with the Starfleet officers and the Jem'Hadar is, in my mind, very analogous to Thomas Hobbes' State of Nature. You know, you've got two groups of people that are basically on opposite sides of the valley, ready to kill each other. And then it's a question of, do the rules apply in this situation? Or is it a free-for-all, everyone for himself, or every group for themselves, trying to save yourself at all costs? You know, if you remember, Thomas Hobbes thought that life in its natural state was nasty, brutish, and short, that in that situation where your life is on the line, your property's on the line, your food is on the line, that rules and justice and ethics just don't apply in that situation, that those things emerge out of a civilized society. So the conversation about whether there are rules in a state of war is a direct analogy to, in my mind, to this classic debate in political philosophy about whether ethics is sort of universal and objective, regardless of what state you're in, a state of peace or a state of war, state of civilized society or a state of nature, or whether those things are only concepts that apply to peaceful societies that are not in a state of war, not in a state of being under threat.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, Rocks and Shoals was not on my short list, but as our listeners know, I oftentimes will start with a very long list and pare that list down. So early on, as I was drafting a list of episodes, Rocks and Shoals was on that list, but I ended up veering towards episodes that weren't as intrinsically connected to the Dominion War arc. And surprisingly enough, here in the heat of the Dominion War, there are actually a number of episodes that either the A plot or the B plot, depending on which one you're kind of drawn to, really kind of take a break from the war theme and delve into the personal development of the characters and other dilemmas that are going on. So I ended up pairing Rocks and Shoals out in favor of some other episodes. But I actually found the B plot, Duncan, you mentioned the B plot in this episode, which I think is as interesting, if not more interesting, than what is going on between the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar. There's certainly something really fascinating about that dynamic between at least these particular Jem'Hadar and their Vorta. But Kira's journey and kind of restarting the resistance. And it's very much different than the resistance that she was used to being a part of as a Bajoran during the occupation by the Cardassians. And so this is very, very different for her. And yet she finds herself back in that position, and she's drawing on her experience, and she's sharing her experience and drawing other people into it. And it, you know, at the end of the day, she, and you mentioned Jake, you know, I'm not sure really whether she inspires Jake or Jake inspires her, but you're right. He very much tips the scales and gets involved, and that really becomes a catalyst for at least what they're able to accomplish. And then, you know, later on we had that whole dynamic with Odo and, you know, kind of checking out, if you will, and almost in his non-involvement, almost seemingly sides with, you know, with the founders.
I think, I mean, it's interesting also, one of the things, this is slightly jumping ahead to a later episode in that arc, but I mean, there is always this, once Kira decides she's going to act, then she and Odo are kind of put up in opposition to each other. And in some ways, rewatching it, I thought, in a way, it's a shame when the female shapeshifter arrives, because that shifts what's going on with Odo into a different level. You know, he's sort of absorbed with her. He's got this whole other agenda going on. But even before that, I think what I think is more interesting is before she arrives, they're already at odds with each other, because Kira has committed to the cause by that point. She wants to cause a lot of trouble. She wants to cause mayhem, basically. And Odo, as I suppose traditionally this sort of person who's obsessed with order and justice and things, you know, keeping things on an even keel, you know, he says to her, basically, I'm spending my whole time trying to calm Dukat and Wayun down, to try to make this occupation as manageable as possible. And you're throwing a spanner in the works. And this was exactly the kind of conversation that was going on, you know, in the Channel Islands, and where the controversy was there, that in Guernsey, the Attorney General of Guernsey, who'd ended up as the kind of de facto president, in a sense, under the Germans, but the highest ranking local person. And the way they ran that administration was the Germans were kind of in charge, but they let the locals continue their government. They let them continue to administer everything. And he was very angry with Churchill, would send these commando raids to the islands, basically just to cause trouble, because he couldn't recapture the islands, which is what he'd like to do. So he thought, well, at least we can kind of cut some phone wires. We can, you know, capture some Germans. We can blow up some of their supplies and so on. And Sherwell, the guy who was in charge, wrote this very angry letter, basically saying, you know, you demilitarized these islands. You asked us to try and keep our lives, keep things going, kind of protect. I'm trying to protect my people, basically butt out, because you're making my job impossible. I can't deal with the Germans on one hand and try to win their trust and so on, if you're coming along and blowing things up the rest of the time. And what's going to happen is my people are going to be rounded up and punished for this. You know, and actually, as he saw it, his duty was to try to keep everyone in line, to prevent resistance, and to kind of, you know, take very much Odo's line in these episodes of kind of, well, we're just, you know, keep things on an even keel and, you know, wait it out, essentially.
I think what I like about the Odo storyline in this episode is that it unveils the myth of neutrality, right? Generally, you sort of think, oh, I can be neutral. I cannot get too involved and let things sort it out. But it's like not throwing the switch in the trolley problem. You're essentially making a choice one way or the other. You know, there will be a set of consequences that unfold whether or not you get involved, and choosing to be uninvolved and stay relatively neutral is essentially making a choice in favor of whatever the dominant power is.
Well, in Odo, I mean, we see in other episodes of Deep Space Nine, Odo's kind of ethically, some of his judgments are a bit questionable, because he does have this kind of real commitment to order. And initially, I think in the series, we see it in very positive light. The Bajorans trust him because they think he's a very just man. The Cardassians will work with him because they know he's not a Bajoran. He's not going to side with the Bajorans for the sake of it. But at the same time, I think there are other episodes where you see that in a slightly more negative light, and you think, well, actually, you know, sometimes this kind of refusal to take sides is in itself, like you say, is a kind of in a situation where there's a majority and a minority, or there's a power dynamic, it is taking sides if you refuse to do anything, and that acts in the interests of the people who are already in power against the people that they're oppressing. So I suppose it's that question that you have in, you know, and we know this from other aspects of World War II, you know, is it your duty to speak out, in a sense, if you're the priest and you're not being persecuted for your religion, but someone else is it your duty to speak out on behalf of them? Because in that situation, you know, you're in a safer position than they are.
Well, I think it might depend what the consequences are. Right? If speaking out puts you in immediate danger to the point where there's literally going to be a phaser rifle to your head and they're going to take you out, right? Then you haven't accomplished anything. So that's ultimately self-defeating. If being part of the resistance leads to, you know, the progressiveness of this revolutionary resistance movement, then you have half a chance of making an impact. But if your life is, say, in immediate danger, you know, if they're just going to, you know, throw you in the brig, or if they're going to execute you, then speaking out is ultimately self-defeating. So it's hard to, as much as we want to say, you know, you have a duty to speak out or not to speak out in this Kantian sense, there is this element of consequentialism to it, where it's like, well, it depends what the consequences are going to be. If that's going to be productive and fruitful, then that's great. If it's not the time to be productive and fruitful, then waiting it out and finding a more opportune time to make an impact by speaking out might be the right thing to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and certainly, you know, in the Channel Islands example, this guy Sherwell, who was in charge, he would defend all his decisions. You know, he would say, basically, I did the right thing. I protected my people. The consequences for them would have been much worse if I hadn't taken this line, and people might not like it, and it might not, you know, we were talking earlier about what are the myths that it kind of, that these stories problematize in terms of our myths about, you know, say Britain never surrenders, Britain never gives up, we fight for what we believe in, and so on. But actually, from a kind of more consequential perspective, in that sense, it, you know, that was, as he saw it, absolutely the right thing to do. He was, and it was, you know, it's very much kind of the getting the best outcome for the most number of people. He's got however many thousands of people that he's responsible for as their leader. He's making a judgment based on that. One of the things I think,
yeah, having to weigh territory versus the number of people involved. Yeah.
I was just going to say that the other thing that I think is so brilliant about this arc at the start of this season is that putting Kira in that situation is just a stroke of brilliance. You know, putting her in the situation where we expect her to be the resistance fighter. We expect her to fight. You know, we spent years hearing about her past and the terrible things that she's done, that she felt she had to do, and so on. But putting her in that situation where she's not actually allowed to fight, she has to, you know, accept the cup of coffee from the Cardassian. She has to sit by them. She has to share the lift with them. We see all these scenes, you know, and by the time she's starting to have this kind of inner turmoil, it's quite heartbreaking. That scene where she goes up to Ops, and after the Vedic has killed herself, she looks like she's about to cry. She's looking around the room. She's like, she's trapped in this situation. She can't be her sort of authentic self, in a way, because of this occupation kind of situation that she's in. She's had to compromise herself, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I found interviewing people who lived through occupation in the Channel Islands was one of the most striking ones. Every person I interviewed over 100 people, and I always asked them what was the worst thing. And some of them would say, well, we couldn't leave the island. It got very boring. We couldn't travel. Some of them would say, we had no food. We were starving. Some of them would say, oh, you know, people were brutalized in various ways, which did occasionally, but rarely happen. But one man, I'll never forget, he broke down in tears telling me this. He said when the war came to an end and they were liberated, he went out in the street and he just wept, because he felt that he had not been able to be himself for those years under occupation. He couldn't trust outside of his own immediate family. He couldn't go to the pub and have a frank conversation with someone about how he felt about something, because he always thought someone was looking over his shoulder, someone might shop him to the authorities. And it had kind of crushed his spirit. It crushed who he was, because he just felt he wasn't allowed to be himself, because he was living under this regime where his kind of individual rights and autonomy in that sense weren't guaranteed. It was, you know, it was all kind of, he could be arrested at any moment. And in some ways, that's what that those scenes with Kira remind me of, is this sense that she is sort of trapped in this situation. She's not being brutalized. She's not having a particularly difficult time, but she just can't be who we know she is because of the situation she's been placed in.
To what extent does the different nature of this second occupation that we see in this story arc chip away at Major Kira's prejudices against the Cardassians to the point where in the very next season, towards the end of the season, she's willing to fight alongside the Cardassians rather than view them as the enemy. Is there something about being forced to be in the same environment with them in this situation that's not as blatant of a resistance situation as, say, the first Cardassian occupation?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Is there a connection there?
I never would have thought of it like that because that's very interesting. The way I saw
Kira
it
has a story
was more
arc,
that
right,
like so. The fact that she has to work with Damar after what happens at the end of this, where she, you know, where he kills the Jarl, it almost makes it harder. Because I suppose we have seen Kira softening in some ways towards the Cardassians and being more willing to accept them. And yet at this point, although it's true she's working sort of day by day with them, but at the same time, politically, they've kind of proved what everyone's worst fears about them. Do you know what I mean? They've kind of thrown away all these years of more promising behaviour. You know, we had Beryl was trying to negotiate a treaty of some kind, I think, before he died, mm-hmm. wasn't he? There was a kind of definitely a warming of relations with them. You know, even with her relationship with Dukat, when they went off to get Zial, there was a kind of, I mean, it's always a strange, tense relationship, but there was an element of kind of a warming relationship in some ways there towards him. And then in some ways, I've always seen it more as like, when the Cardassians side with the Dominion, that's kind of right, that's it. You know, all of that's sort of out the window and we're back to almost a square one. They've kind of proved where their colours really lie. But it's interesting, I mean, it is fascinating that she should end up fighting alongside them. But then I think, again, that's kind of the writers just always pushing everything to the extreme and putting people in the last situation you'd expect to find her in. So you take this Bajoran resistance fighter. In this season, you put her in a situation where she has to work alongside them and be a good, you know, be a good, well-behaved kind of, almost like a sort of politician, you know, go along with the regime and not cause trouble. And then later on, she's got to actually fight for those people that she, you know, hate so much.
It's a very Star Trek thing to do, right? Mm. To take former enemies, put them together in a situation where they're forced to, you know, respect each other and work together and reconcile rather than viewing each other as perpetual enemies that can never be reconciled. Yeah.
Well, and I think her relationship with Legate Gamorre, I think that had a lot to do with informing her personal feelings about the Cardassians. She's really able to see that it's not a Cardassian problem. She's able to separate the people from the actions of a few. I think even in the Dominion, in that scene where she looks herself in the mirror, I mean, it was just brilliant all the way around. I think that's the moment where she realizes that she's not being her authentic self and she has this obligation to act. But I don't know, in some respects, I almost feel as though she is able to separate the Cardassian people from, you know, just the blind power hunger that is Gul Dukat and this alliance that he's formed with the Dominion. It's almost like a resistance against the Dominion, not necessarily against the Cardassians. And you talked about the parallels to World War II. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor, and you know, he comes to this place where he sees, even within his own family, his sister was married to a German Jew, and he sees the brutality of the German regime against the Jewish people, and he just comes to a place, and he's credited with saying, "Silence in the face of evil is evil itself." And he says, "God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act." And so what does he do? He becomes an ally spy, and he is one of the leaders of the German resistance, and he ended up going to the gallows as a result of it, just nearly a mere 30 days before the end of German dominance in World War II. He's sent to the gallows for it, and he dies for his actions in trying to assassinate Adolf Hitler. And so I see a lot of parallels there, but I think Kira is able to really separate, much the same way that Dietrich Bonhoeffer allowed the rest of the world to separate the German people from the acts of a regime. And I really feel like that is built into the story, and that it's captured in a very good light.
Well, I guess we do see in some ways in Deep Space Nine that there are that there is a an ambivalence on the part of a lot of the Cardassians about the pact that they've signed with the Dominion, the fact that they've joined the Dominion. You know, even I feel like that sort of starts coming out. Well, it comes out in the, in this occupation because they're constantly butting heads, you know, and Damar is not keen on Wayoon and the Dominion at all, I don't think. Dukat has made this decision for kind of political reasons. How many, you know, whether everyone is necessarily signed up to it or on board with it is kind of a bit less clear. It seems sort of obvious that there are a lot of people who are questioning whether they've done the right thing because they've taken a terrific gamble, essentially, and they're giving up, you know, they're giving up their own freedom to a certain extent and their own self-determination because they're, you know, and we have these scenes where Wayoon is kind of putting Dukat in his place, or when the female shapeshifter arrives, there's this kind of the power dynamic sort of shifts again, and it's very much like, well, everyone works for her. And to see Dukat in that situation is quite interesting because we sort of think of him as leading the Cardassians at this point, as being the man in charge, being the you know, the one who makes the decisions, and actually he isn't, which is kind of fascinating in itself, because a big part of the question around that character and his sort of history, not to jump ahead to a future episode in this season, but it does centre on this question of how much is he in charge of his own decisions, how much is he responsible for his own decisions, and you know, he's in a sense the highest ranking Cardassian that we ever see, but he's not Hitler in that sense, because he's not at the top of the organisation, he's not the one ultimately making the decisions, he's the kind of man on the ground carrying them out in some way. So,
and given his temperament, it's strangely satisfying to see him have to take a back seat once in a
while. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Zachary, shall we move along? Do you want to share your next pick?
Absolutely. So my next pick is predictably In the Pale Moonlight. And we did an entire episode of Metatrex on In the Pale Moonlight, so I won't spend too much time on this one, but I do want to say that I think in all of Star Trek, you won't find an episode that more clearly juxtaposes rule-based Kantian ethics and utilitarian-based consequentialist ethics. You know, whether Captain Sisko is justified in taking what would in an isolated situation be, you know, horrible, unethical actions leading to the death of a Romulan senator, whether actions like that are, in an isolated case would be clearly morally and ethically wrong for the sake of achieving some greater outcome, you know, overall good consequences. I think in all of Star Trek, that's the most clear depiction of that juxtaposition of these two diametrically opposed ethical theories.
In the Pale Moonlight was my number two pick for this season, and for all the reasons that you mentioned. It is such an interesting ethical dilemma, and the outcome is not what necessarily one might expect. Sisko takes some very questionable actions here, some very non-Starfleet kind of actions, and he acknowledges as much, and there's a cover-up even. I mean, the very end of the episode, he deletes the file so that there's no log about this. So, I mean, it's not just the action itself, it's the cover-up.
Well, I think we need to be careful how we describe it, because, again, it's not a question of he does some things that are intrinsically wrong, and so, you know, look at all the bad things he did for the sake of some greater good. It's that it's a genuinely open question whether those things are wrong in light of the fact that they do lead to overall good consequences. You could plausibly say those were just totally justifiable, correct actions to take, given the consequences that they led to. So, you know, we have to be just a little careful about how we describe Sisko's actions, because there's a temptation to say, oh, look at all the bad things he did, but look at all the good consequences they led to. But on the consequentialist theory, those are good actions because they led to good consequences, even though on a different ethical theory, they look like horrible actions.
Well, you have the old adage, all is fair in love and war. And I think we really see that played out here. And if you subscribe to that philosophy, if that saying is part of your personal philosophy, then you could certainly argue that all was fair and, you know, really deceiving this Romulan senator and ultimately allowing Garak to assassinate him and the cover-up, one could really argue there. You're absolutely right that everything that he did was completely justifiable and rightful.
It really is almost the logical conclusion of the discussion we were having about rocks and shoals, about whether there are rules in a state of war. If we're in Hobbes's state of nature here, where there are no rules inside of war, then any action Sisko takes that leads to the ending of the war and returning to a state of civilized society is a justifiable action.
So I didn't have this episode on my list only because, I mean, I love this episode. I think it's one of the best DS9 episodes. One of
you
the
knew
best
we were going
to
pick it.
Well, not just that I knew you were going to pick it, but more that I felt that you'd covered it in, because you devoted the whole episode to it. And I actually went back and listened to that episode of Metatrex again and thought, well, can I really add anything to this? And I decided, you know, we can just almost refer people to go back there for a more in-depth discussion. The only thing that jumped out at me rewatching it this time, though, that I thought was maybe kind of interesting, coming from a British perspective, and I don't know whether this resonates differently to you as Americans, is in the Second World War context, this is a story. America are the Romulans. Do you know what I mean? That's who the Romulans are sort of standing in for. They're the ones that everyone needs in the war in order to have a chance of winning the war. And what are we going to do to get America into the war? And again, historically, you know, the president was very keen for America to join the war. There was a lot of resistance politically to it. It wasn't possible. And then Pearl Harbor came along and the politics changed. And I know there are some people who believe that there's an element of a conspiracy to that story. And this is, you know, this is kind of on the fringes of official history, really. But there is, you know, a case can be made that the situation at Pearl Harbor, that there are certain things that maybe don't add up. And the fact is, whether this is what happened or not, the president did have an interest in that happening. Pearl Harbor, tragic as it is for those people who lost their lives, saved a lot more lives. And in a way, I suppose that would open up, you know, if we discovered that those conspiracy theories were true, that would open up a whole can of worms about, you know, what was the right thing to do in that situation. And the fact is, we have similar analogous situations in the Second World War because, for example, when at Bletchley Park, they cracked the German codes, which meant that they were intercepting German communications, but they didn't want the Germans to know that they'd cracked their codes, which meant that although they could use the information to a certain extent, there were other situations where they couldn't protect. You know, for example, a submarine might be falling into an ambush effectively, and they couldn't tell them because if they reacted in too obvious a way, it would be clear that the codes have been compromised. So you have a situation there where a commander is literally, you know, sending people to their deaths essentially in order to kind of preserve that official narrative. So I guess I'm just thinking there's a kind of parallel there between, you know, these kind of underhand means that are going on at the same time as this kind of the official story about what's happening and why it's happening.
Well, I think the trouble with relying on consequences in terms of how to evaluate the moral character of an action is that consequences are unpredictable, right? In World War II, World War II might have ended well, might have ended badly. And so that would change our characterization of how the President of the United States was perceiving Pearl Harbor at the time and the role played and the response to that in the outcome of a war. So to apply that to Sisko, right? If Sisko's actions genuinely do lead to the end of the Dominion War, then we praise him and go, look at all those great things he did. Yeah, they might have looked like terrible actions, but from a consequential standpoint, it looks great. Mm-hmm. But if it turns out that the Federation had lost the Dominion War, then we would view those actions as Sisko's folly. Mm-hmm. And so it seems strange to wait for the outcome of a very unpredictable, complex consequences to be able to evaluate individual actions in the past or in the moment.
And this is one of the problems that I think we have with history. And it's something that I'm always quite aware of, you know, working on the Second World War, is that we have a tendency because it's all in the past and we know what did happen. It's almost, I think, part of the challenge as a historian is to kind of remind yourself that to get into the moment of what it was like living through these, because the kind of books that I write, they're closer to biography than history in a sense. They're very much on the ground history. They're how ordinary people live through these things. And it's the kind of realization that something like D-Day, we all know what D-Day represents as a kind of turning point. You know, we know that it was successful. We know that that kind of ushered in the last phase of the war and sort of from then on we were going to win. But, you know, on the morning of that day, people didn't know that. In the build-up to D-Day, people didn't know that. And the fact is it could easily have gone the other way. And there are these factors that aren't necessarily predictable. You know, the weather plays a big role. The personality quirks of someone like Hitler makes bad decisions that couldn't be predicted. And, you know, I think it's important that this is, again, jumping ahead a bit to another episode that I want to talk about in a little while. But, you know, to recognise when we think about history that okay, we know how things turned out, but if you're thinking about it at the time and the decisions people are making, the situation that they're in and their experience of history, they don't know, you know, and there are these moments where history is on a knife edge. It could go one way and it could go the other. And I guess trying to sort of capture that and recognize that, I think, is quite important if we're going to look at our own history and really understand what it meant to people.
Yeah, and you definitely don't know what consequences will ensue down the road. You know, what connections the actions of today or the actions of yesterday will have to the events of 50 years from now, or 100 years from now, or 1,000 years from now. You know, I think in our modern world, we can point to events 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 50 years ago, and point to events that we're experiencing today for the first time. You know, the rise of say ISIS and Islamic terrorism and whatnot. Those, you know, things that looked like perfectly justifiable, plausible actions can be viewed in a new light based on consequences that were not predictable at the time. Mm-hmm. So we can't really fault anyone for them, but we can analyze the causal connection between past events and current events, or present events and future events, only after those events have unfolded. Mm-hmm. So there's a fine line between you know, looking back at history and being judgmental towards people who didn't know what they didn't know, right? They didn't know what the consequences were going to be. They were doing the best they can in the moment, but recognizing the fact that there are causal connections between what happened or what is happening now and what either is happening now or will happen in the future.
Well, as Duncan mentioned, Zachary, you and I have covered In the Pale Moonlight extensively in an episode of Metatrex. And if our listeners are interested in going back to our back catalog and checking that out, it goes all the way back to November 2015. It is episode 6, entitled Whacking Vrenak. Again, Zachary and I talk exclusively about In the Pale Moonlight, and we compare the difference between consequentialism and deontological ethics.
And here in this episode of Metatrex, we have officially retconned that title to Sisko's Folly.
Well, guys, I'm going, In the Pale Moonlight was on my list as well. So I'm going to offer up the episode Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night. And the reason I chose this episode, I really appreciate the dilemma that Kira finds herself in. She has been presented with the idea that her mom, her mother, Kira Maru, was a collaborator, which to Kira Nerys is just a detestable thought. She was raised believing that her mother had died, and now she is being told by Gul Dukat that her mother actually was his mistress. And so she goes to Sisko. She gets permission to use the Orb of Time. She time travels back and has the opportunity to spend some time with her mother during the occupation on Terok-Nor. And at first, she is just appalled at what she finds, that there is some truth to what Gul Dukat finds out. But she's able to look at it in, you know, a much more detailed light, rather than just the surface that, you know, my mother was Gul Dukat's mistress. She actually sees the humanity that is the truth of what was going on. And it informs not only her opinion of her mother going forward, but I think in many ways it informs her and what she views as acceptable and unacceptable during the remainder, rather, of the Dominion War. So a lot of really interesting ethical things going on here. Zachary, you and I have talked many times about our interest in our own genealogy, and you and I both are researching our genealogy. So there was a lot of fascinating take home from this episode about that, because as we're researching genealogy, it's easy to make these discoveries and say, well, you know, my great-great-grandfather served in the war, or he did this, or he did that, he was a farmer, or whatever. But beyond that, there's the layer of a person. And we may even uncover family members within our family trees who have done, you know, horrific things. But I think it's important to remember that there is a humanity that lies beneath the surface of what you can find, in a genealogy search. And I think that's really, in many ways, what Kara Nerisse discovers about Kira Maru, is that in spite of the fact that she shared Dukat's bed, and there's this really great kind of confrontation that she has with Kira Maru, and Kira Maru says, "You're calling me a collaborator because I shared Dukat's bed?" And Kira says, "No, because you like sharing his bed, because you've fallen in love with him." So she's trying to reconcile these actions that her mother has taken, and she's trying to put her in a box, and her mom is saying to her, "You can't put me in that box. There's more to it. I'm a person, and this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. This is why I've resigned to it." And so Kira is able to make some peace with that, even though it's uncomfortable for her.
Well, I think there's a danger, and Duncan, I think you'll appreciate this and probably have more to say about this than I do, given your interest in history. There's a danger in building up an overwhelmingly positive narrative about a historical figure, whether it's an ancestor, a direct mm-hmm. ancestor, in this case, someone's immediate parent, or a historical figure, like over here in the United States, it might be Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, right? You can develop this reverent narrative about these individuals that is... to some degree accurate, you know, it's based on actual historical events, but probably ignoring the factors that shed those characters in a less than favorable light. You know, we can ignore the things we don't like and emphasize the things we do like, and you get a less historically accurate picture when you do that. So there's a danger of developing a narrative about any historical figure, you know, ancestor or otherwise. And I think this episode reveals that the narrative that Kira has about her mother is not as accurate as she'd like to think it is. And history is complicated like that. I mean, you know, when we look back at history, whether it's our own family history or whether it's, actual historical events, we're only getting a fraction of the picture. We're getting the things that have been passed down, the events that have been emphasized. We're not getting the events that have been forgotten about, or the events that people are intentionally forgetting about for the sake of developing a narrative. And you have to be very careful when doing either genealogy and ancestry or history in trying to avoid uncovering just those facts that reinforce the narrative that you already hold. Mm.
Definitely, that's true. And I mean, I'd say, and this is not so much just to talk about an individual's good and bad qualities, but also for my kind of work, when I'm interviewing people and trying to find out how they felt at a particular time, to be aware of the kind of power of those broader narratives. I mean, one of the things that came out in my research into the Channel Islands was that I've mentioned how the Germans generally treated the islanders very well, but there was another group of people who were not treated well, and those were the forced labourers who they brought from France, from Russia, from conquered countries or parts of conquered countries, to basically do the work of fortifying the islands, building the bunkers and so on. And a lot of people witnessed some of the cruelty that was meted out to these people, and were aware that they were being treated very differently to how they were. Now, one of the things that's interesting is I interviewed over 100 people. Every single person told me how sorry they felt for these poor people, how awful it was. They wished they could do something to help. Some of them said, "Oh, well, we didn't have much food, but we'd give them a scrap of our dinner or something if we could do anything to help them." And this is not to say that all those people were lying, because I'm sure much of that is true, and many people did have these reactions. But when you look at the kind of primary sources, you look at people's diaries and accounts at the time, there's another whole narrative which no one is going to repeat to me 70 years later, which is people saying things like, "Oh, these dirty people arriving on our island, the scum of the earth. Where do they find these people? They're probably all criminals. You know, I don't want them around. I don't feel safe with them, you know, living on my island." You know, and this very kind of, an element of racism, an element of xenophobia. I mean, almost what we see today with refugees or asylum seekers or so. And there's often these very different narratives about, you know, how people feel about these people. Do they feel pity towards them, or do they feel a kind of anxiety and a sort of instinctive hostility? So I think that's definitely true what you're saying about these kind of historical narratives. Today, there's a consensus: we felt sorry for them. We partly because we know about the Holocaust, we know how not the Nazis really, you know, the kind of the worst things that they did, and we can see that this is sort of on a sliding scale leading to those kind of atrocities. And so that's kind of the narrative. I had this episode for me. It wasn't on my top list, but it was my very, very heavily underlined top honourable mention. I think this is a fascinating episode. I think it's really interesting. I think it ties in on one level with what we were talking about in Rocks and Shoals. Actually, there's an interesting conversation between Kira and her mother, which parallels, I think, the conversation between Kira and the Vedic in that episode, where Kira says to her mother, he's the enemy, speaking of Descartes, and her mother says it's not mm-hmm. that simple, and she says, yes, it is. And we have this kind of similar conversation between Kira and the Vedic earlier on. Kira's saying, this occupation is different. You know, and the Vedic says, is it? Basically, well, yes, you know, in some specific ways we can see that, but on some essential level, the situation is more simple than you want to claim that it is. So there's always this kind of tension between complexity, ambiguity, shades of grey, which in some ways is what DS9 does so well, and saying actually on some of these kind of moral issues there is a black and white line. You know, there is a clear answer, there's a clear cut, this is right and this is wrong, and you're crossing it. The other thing, I think it was interesting, you were talking, Mike, about this line about that she became a collaborator not for sleeping with Descartes to help her family, but for falling in love with him. I mean, that is a very interesting distinction that she's making there. I'm not sure it's really fair, but it interests me because it's... because I suppose it ties into this idea that you have with fraternization under occupation, that there are kind of two types of fraternizers. There are the type that are essentially the equivalent of sort of gold diggers in a lot of these kind of narratives. This is, again, talking about in my research. There's a lot of hostility towards women who would go out with German officers because they'd get a bit more food or they'd get some nice clothes. You know, if you're living under occupation, you're living quite a basic existence, you're cut off, and they have access to things that locals don't have access to. So you kind of have people who are seen as sort of social climbing almost, or kind of enhancing their lifestyle, and people are very hostile to them. Then you have people sometimes like quite naive young girls who fall in love with a soldier. In some cases, they even married them, you know, years down the line. And there's a bit more tolerance of that. Like maybe they think they're a bit naive and silly, but if they fell in love, that's what's interesting. So in the narratives I hear, if they fell in love, then that's kind of different. It's, well, maybe they were stupid to do that, but at the same time, you can't really blame them. People meet other people, even if they're the enemy, they do fall in love, that's going to happen, you know, and there's a kind of different element there.
Do you suppose on a psychological level, Stockholm Syndrome might play a part in this?
Yeah, probably. Well, I think with Kira's mother, it's a very complicated and sort of ambiguous situation, isn't it? Because there's this, she is trapped. I mean, she's not, you know, the people that I've been speaking to about fraternization and so on, they are essentially free agents. They're living in a compromised situation, but they are kind of free agents. These are actually sex slaves. You know, these are, they're comfort women, you know, comfort women we had in the Japanese army. You know, these are basically this kind of forced prostitution in a sense, what they're being pushed into. And obviously, Kira can't blame them for that. I mean, that's a horrible aspect of the way that they're being brutalized and treated. Mm-hmm. But she is blaming her for the extent to which she's kind of voluntarily extending that, in a sense. And I suppose not behaving the way Kira is behaving, quite recklessly, of openly defying it. And which we sort of have to see, because even though this is only a sort of, it's slightly unclear to me, is it a vision? Is it a genuine time travel experience? You know, what's going on? But we can't have Kira being raped by these Cardassians in the episode. We wouldn't accept that. So she has to find a way of, you know, getting the guy drunk and sort of getting out of it, which sort of slightly sidesteps the issue. But so I think maybe when we look at her mother, we have to bear that in mind, that it's not, she's not someone, and this did happen, whose husband is away, maybe serving in the forces, and she meets a German and has an affair. That's not the situation. She has actually essentially been kidnapped and is being forced into a kind of prostitution, sure, in a sense. And she's making, you know, on one level, maybe she's making a calculation, and on another, there's a genuine emotional component to it. And Descartes is a very manipulative person. And I think one of the things that interests me about this, and interests me about this topic of fraternization more generally, is, you know, in my research in the Channel Islands, I interviewed over 100 people. I was trying to get all different aspects of the occupation. I know a lot of people had relationships with Germans. It was, you know, it was a significant thing that happened at that time. everyone had something to say about it, and almost no one would admit to having done it. You know, of the women that I spoke to, it's such a taboo. And even now, you know, there are other things that people did, trading, sort of black market trading, or other kind of questionable activities that, you know, might fall loosely under kind of collaboration or things like that. People are much more willing to forgive. But a lot of people I spoke to, you know, 70 years later, they'll say, oh, I thought it was disgusting, those women. You know, they betrayed us. They were betraying their country, sleeping with the enemy. And I think there's a real sexist element to that in a way. And it sort of illuminates the pressures that are placed on women by war and how different they are from the pressures that are placed on men and what the expectations are. And, you know, men are expected to go out and fight and prove their loyalty that way. Women are expected to prove their loyalty in different ways, in a sense. And it really struck me, you know, the extent to which, you know, 70 years on, the general message or the kind of general story that comes out for these people is one of kind of forgiveness, of moving on. You know, we forgive the Germans for being the enemy. We forgive the people who made these bad decisions and so on. But the one group of people that a lot of these men and women will never forgive are the women who, you know, who slept with them, basically. And they can't get over that. There's something that it sticks for them. They can't forgive that. And I think that is, so I think it's interesting. This episode sort of touches on that and the kind of, you know, wrongs darker than death or night. Who are these wrongs, the occupation's wrongs? Are these de Kutt's wrongs? Or are these the wrongs of the mother, you know, which I suppose is the strong implication, is that, you know, what she's done is to Kira almost worse than anything else. And I suppose it causes us to question, is that the case? You know, at the end of the episode, Sisko basically says she did what she had to, which is this kind of consequentialist argument that we hear again and again in this series. You know, people are doing things that they wouldn't normally do. They're breaking their own rules because of the situation. But ultimately, does, you know, Kira doesn't really buy that. She doesn't accept it.
So, Duncan, I believe the next pick is yours. We've each offered up a pick. We've got a couple of crossovers. So what's next on your list?
Okay, so my next choice is Statistical Probabilities. This is the episode where the group of genetically enhanced patients comes to the station and Bashir works with them, and they begin to do this sort of statistical analysis of the war situation and come to believe essentially that they can predict what's going to happen next. And this is kind of going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the danger historically looking back in seeing everything as somehow predictable. And because part of what history is, I suppose, is trying to show how one thing led to another or why one thing influenced another in a certain way. So there's a kind of teleological danger there, in a sense. And I think this episode, well, it has several things about it that interest me. One is simply this question of, to what extent can we predict the future? To what extent are these things kind of predictable? Can we look at the kind of broad sweep of history and say we see where this is going? And if we can tell these kind of grand narratives historically, what is the role of the individual in that? Because, you know, for me in my work, I'm much more focused on the individual level, on the individual experience. So where is the individual in that? And I suppose the episode has some things to say about that to the extent that basically the whole thesis is undermined by the fact that this mute girl decides to do something that no one expects her to do, because she's a very small, seemingly insignificant player in kind of global events. Mm-hmm. And yet she plays this kind of pivotal role that was completely unpredictable, or at least unpredicted. And we do see that with the Dominion War later on. There are these kind of unpredictable elements that keep the wheel spinning, the kind of wheel of fortune, keep it spinning, keep things up in the air. You know, the introduction of Section 31, which kind of changes our understanding of what the ground rules are and what the context is, the fact that Damar becomes an alcoholic and what influence that has, the fact that, I mean, this is jumping forward to the next season, but, you know, de Kutt's role in kind of nudging him out of that, these kind of quite small psychological things. And similarly, you know, we see in real life with the people making these decisions. You know, I mentioned Hitler making some very strange, irrational decisions, the kind of role that these things have. Obviously, we've seen the role of the prophets, literally kind of deus ex machina situation at the start of the season, proving that we can't, that the predictions that we might make about this war in terms of these people have this number of ships, these people have this number of men in their army, that these things aren't necessarily as simple as that. So I think the episode is interesting in that it kind of it shows up some of these flaws in thinking in this kind of teleological way. But the other thing that really fascinates me about it is really leaving all that to one side, the crucial question I think is fascinating about this episode is that it sort of asks this question, when is it right to surrender? If you're fighting the good fight, you're fighting for a noble cause, you're doing all those things that we talked about, you know, you're standing up, you're doing the right thing. When do we surrender? And I think it's a very difficult question for us to answer. You know, in England, we haven't surrendered since 1066. I don't think America as a country has ever surrendered on its, you know, on its own territory. When do you, I mean, I'm talking about surrender to an invader who's invading your land, going to take you over. At what point do you stop fighting? But the fact is, you know, in the Second World War, we were unusual in that, you know, France surrendered, the other countries, they surrendered, they got brought to that point where they had to hold their hands up and accept that. And I'm sort of curious, you know, what does that do to you as a country? What does that do to your sense of who you are, to, you know, to all these things? And what does it mean to make that decision? Because we see in Star Trek, you know, surrendering a ship is a huge deal. We see that in The Wrath of Khan. We see it in The Undiscovered Country. Both those films, Kirk surrenders the ship and it's a big dramatic moment. And in a sense, you know, we've got this same situation on a broader level. Is the entire Federation going to surrender in a similar situation because they find a fight they can't win? And actually, historically, we could have surrendered. I mean, there's quite an interesting novel I read last year called Dominion, which is one of these kind of counterfactual novels. It's set in London under German rule, essentially. So it's a sort of counterfactual Second World War narrative. But unlike a lot of those stories in which there's been a fight, there's been an invasion, we've sort of been militarily brought to the brink. The one difference in that story between real history and the history in the story is that instead of Churchill, Halifax ended up being prime minister, and the author of the novel posits that basically Halifax would have made peace with Germany in some form or another. And the fact is, you know, that was kind of on the cards. I mean, Churchill in some ways was quite unusual in being so determined not to surrender to Germany, so determined to fight whatever the cost, you know, that kind of almost irrational attitude, which is sort of what I suppose Sisko and O'Brien and these kind of quite emotional human characters are putting up against this kind of cool reason of Dr. Bashir saying, look at the figures, look at the numbers, you know, we've done the calculations, this is the truth in a sense. And they're sort of saying, I don't accept it, you know, I can't argue with any of the facts, but I won't believe in that. It's a matter of faith almost to just say, I'm not going to accept that truth even if it's staring me in the face. And sometimes we need that.
This episode, Statistical Probabilities, to me seems to speak to the heart of the right way to think about history and by extension our connection to future events. Do we think of history and world events in terms of these grand narratives, whether they're the sort of quasi-mystical grand narratives of, say, Hegel, or whether they're nationalistic narratives that a country might tell about itself? Do we view history in these grand, sweeping, connected terms that are predictable and that we can understand deterministically or statistically or otherwise? Or do we view history and future events as a series of unpredictable, disconnected, chaotic events to the point where we can't accurately predict what is coming down the pipeline in the future, or make obvious connections between past events and current events? In general, I mean, personally, I have this kind of innate dislike for statistics. And I think, and this is maybe an existentialist point, that statistics can be an excuse not to take personal responsibility mm-hmm. for things. If you say, here's what the statistics and the data and the information says we should do because of blah, 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 that gives you the perfect excuse for not being personally responsible for the choices that you have to make in response to those predictions or those calculations. So, I don't know. I sort of feel like statistics is just an excuse. It's an out. It's not. It's, you know, I have much more respect for people who say, you know, information be damned, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to do what I think of as the right thing to do, regardless of what the information is telling me. I think of that as almost more praiseworthy than being able to sort of get down in the weeds and pick apart the data and say, okay, well, now here's what the data says we should do, so that's what we're going to do. It's almost like you're putting your fate in the numbers' hands at that point, rather than, you know, taking fate by the horns and making the world into what you want it to be. So I don't like this approach to you know, relating to what to do about the future. I just think that that's not how we are as people. You know, we're people who have to, you know, make hard decisions in response to whatever the data says, and the data never is the final word on what we do as people. It's how we respond to those data that that reveals who we are as a people. So, so two things, you know, just the nature of history and the nature of world events, the connectedness or otherwise, and then what's our response to that? Do we surrender ourselves and our fate to whatever the data reveals, or do we exert our free will and say, no, here's what we're going to do, regardless of what the data says?
This is not one of my favorite episodes, but it is one of my honorable mentions. I enjoy the exploration, and like you, Zachary, I'm not a big fan of statistics. And this episode, I think, really encapsulates why. Because they're looking at these mathematical probabilities, and they're saying, hey, we need to surrender. If we're going to save millions of lives, we just need to give up the war and just let it go. But I really appreciate there's this conversation inside the episode, and they basically say, regardless of what the statistics say, you know, if we're going down, we're going to go down fighting. And I appreciate the power of mathematics and what we're able to predict with math. I mean, World War II, we had Alan Turing who, you know, invents a machine that basically goes through all of the mathematical probabilities of code, and he's able to use this device to crack the German code. And so I have an appreciation for mathematics, for the probabilities that can be calculated. But at the end of the day, there are so many random, you know, it's existentialism, it's personal agency that really I think can be very unpredictable. And again, this episode really encapsulates that. But again, one of my honorable mentions, because I think it's an interesting exploration nonetheless. Not a favorite episode, but interesting.
Well, like we mentioned at the beginning of the show, this is only the first of a two-part discussion we had with Duncan Barrett. We were having such a good discussion, but we took such a long time. We didn't want to cut anything out, but we didn't want to take too much of your time in one sitting. So we'll be back next week with episode 61. We'll finish the two-part discussion we had with Duncan. In the meantime, season 6 of Deep Space Nine isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
I'm a little worried that B'Elanna didn't care enough about Chakotay to try any Klingon medicine on him.
What would it be? Just blood wine?
Klingon bloodletting? I don't know.
Percussive maintenance.
A nice warm bowl of gach.
To the face.
Klingon chicken soup.
Or even banana pancakes.
Prune juice. A warrior's prune.
Chakotay, have a bite of a heart of targ and wash it down with some prune juice.
Warp 5.
Well, they decided to come out with something called the 1701 line, which is always cute. Retailers always want to do 1701, or they make the price $17.01, and that's real cute, except when you have 100,000 people who want a figure and you're only releasing 1701 of that figure, you're disappointing a lot of completists.
Literary Treks.
But still, at the same time, you're left with that what if, you know? And I know that, like, the Parallels episode gives you a couple of brief glimpses of Riker in command after Picard is dead, and it doesn't seem to be going well for Mr. Riker at that point.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
He has worked with Robert Rodriguez. He was Rodriguez's cinematographer before Rodriguez started shooting his own movies, having worked with him on From Dusk Till Dawn, not the TV show From Dusk Till Dawn, the original masterpiece.
That's always where we go right off the rails, right? You throw in the word masterpiece right there.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit that subscribe button. It helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. Well, if you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTrek, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
On Facebook, it is facebook.com/trekfm, and while you're there, be sure to check out the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. It is a closed group, but if you hit the join button, one of our admins will let you right in. That is the Babel Conference. It's B-A-B-E-L. Just type that into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTrek on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not busy brushing up on your World War II history, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, certainly on Facebook, that's where I'm most active, occasionally around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And if you're interested in reading my blog about the process of writing and publishing and a little bit about life, you can check that out at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not calculating the statistical probabilities of success, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's dedicated Voyager podcast, along with my co-host there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrek team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. And a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTrek. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle @MagicDrop5. My co-host of To the Journey, Kay Shaw. You can find her @ChocoWeeble. And our newest associate producer on MetaTrek, Kit Lofstadt. You can find her under the Twitter handle @MotherCat. And that's mother with a zero. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTrek, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers and no historians have gone before.